Lecture 30, Niccolo Machiavelli.
The conditions that gave rise to the sack of Rome also created Niccolo Machiavelli, at least the Machiavelli that we know from the single work of the Prince, which is the most read of all of his rather voluminous writings. Machiavelli is greatly misunderstood because usually people only read the Prince. It's necessary, in fact, to understand why this fervent, brilliant Republican could write a book about the need for tyranny. And to understand Machiavelli is to some extent understand the world in which he lived. And that is the world that produced the sack of Rome and other terrible events, which we shall be discussing in the next few lectures. Niccolo Machiavelli was born in Florence in May of 1469, the very year that Lorenzo de' Medici assumed control of his city. And Machiavelli's early life then corresponded to that great moment of promise, that glorious years of Lorenzo de' Medici's patronage. Laurentian Florence was indeed an almost ideal and wonderful place, especially for one of Machiavelli's birth and training. His family was from amongst the most honored ranks of the patriciate, but a relatively poor branch, to the point that his father actually worked for a living. He practiced law, although he himself enjoyed a very elegant humanist education. Young Niccolo himself was given a superb humanist education in the classics, which he knew extraordinarily well, and he was allowed to follow his particular interest in the Roman historians. But his life would in fact follow the history of the Republic. He was just 25 when his world was shattered by the French invasions of 1494. He was in the city and he witnessed the expulsion of the Medici in that year. He watched the rise of Savonarola and watched that regime unfold. He was also present in the Piazza della Signoria for the friar's execution in 1498. The restoration of the broadly based republic that followed Savonarola's death in 1498 saw the appointment of the 29-year-old Machiavelli as second chancellor of the republic. This was a job that gave him the responsibility for translating the executive decisions of the government into actual policy. And everyone noted that Machiavelli was brilliant, and brilliant at his job. He was a natural administrator. He was a shrewd observer of current events, and he was a brilliant synthesizer of reports and diplomatic dispatches. These, in fact, are read to this day as models of their genre. Not only his insight, but his elegant style and his remarkable clarity gave the impression that not only did he understand the events going on around him, but that, in fact, he was able to use this evidence to counsel others. Because of his skills, he was sent in 1500 as a representative to King Louis XII of France. This, for the young man, was a formative moment. It was one, in fact, that influenced the way that his mind would develop over the next few years. He realized there, and this was a terrible shock to him, that the fate of Italy was not being determined in the peninsula itself, but the fate of Italy was being decided north of the Alps, at the courts of the kings of France and the court of Ferdinand and Isabella. In Italy itself, there was nothing but division. There was no force strong enough to actually stand against these great dynastic monarchies. And what a painful lesson it was for Machiavelli, given his humanist education and his belief that Italy really was the heir of great Roman empires and republics, that he saw Italy as the natural intellectual and cultural heir of the ancient world. He saw the northerners as barbarians, a term that he used almost constantly to describe the barbarians. They were the ones who were the descendants not of the great Romans, but of the tribes that had destroyed that empire. They were, in Machiavelli's eyes, truly the scions of barbarian chiefs. And he also realized, like those late Romans, he was witnessing a time when the fate of Italy was determined by them. Soon after his return to Florence in 1501, Machiavelli was sent as an agent to Cesare Borgia, the son of Alexander VI Borgia, in order to try and further Florentine interests and to protect the Florentine Republic as far as possible. And here, Machiavelli, who learned as much as he could from every situation in which he found himself, did acquire a great deal. First, he saw Cesare Borgia in action. he saw an Italian who appeared to be taking events into his own hands and directing them using the same techniques as the barbarians, using those techniques of ruthlessness, of brutality that had made the barbarians, that is the northern Europeans, successful in their attacks on Italy. So here was an Italian who may, in fact, be able to learn the lessons and to do something to protect Italy against those savages. Second, he heard Cesare's advice to Florence, which Cesare repeated to Machiavelli on a number of occasions. He said that Florence lacked consistency in policy and lacked resolution. Florence was not resolute because it was a republic. It had to reach consensus decisions. It had to compromise. In times of crisis, he said, cities need a single voice, a single ruler. His suggestion to Machiavelli was to convince the Florentines to take back the Medici. Not very likely, but nevertheless, more information that Machiavelli filed away. Machiavelli was, after all, a committed ideological republican. He listened to this, and he didn't particularly like the advice, but at the same time, he saw that there was a kind of reasonable consistency to it. What he learned from the French and what he learned from Cesare were all put together as part of his memory bank to be spent later when the situation became truly critical. Florence came to agree with Cesare and the French, though, as witnessed by Piero Soderini's election as Gonfalonieri for life in 1502, as we discussed before, giving Soderini the position almost of a kind of Venetian doge, allowed for that singular policy and that sustenance, the continuity of policy that would allow then Florence to stand against the concentrated efforts and brutality of the northerners. In 1503, Soderini, who was extremely close to Machiavelli, in fact, Soderini was Machiavelli's mentor. Those in Florence at the time used to refer to Machiavelli as il manarino di Soderini, that is, Soderini's puppet. They were very close. Machiavelli was often seen as Soderini's spokesman, and Soderini felt his responsibility to further the career of this brilliant young man who seemed to be able to see everything and digest it and turn it into good, clear advice. Once more, Machiavelli was sent to Cesare Borgia. 1503 was a very dangerous year, and Florence realized the ambitions of the Borgia, and he also realized that it was absolutely necessary to try and protect Florentine interests and the integrity of the territory of Florence against the expansion of the Papal States through the arm of Borgia. However, Machiavelli became entranced once more with Cesare. He was entranced by his energy, by his ruthlessness, and by his single-mindedness. Cesare would not let anything, not pity, not religion, not oaths or promises, interfere with what he saw as necessary policy. Machiavelli didn't particularly like this, but he also realized that perhaps it was the only solution to the situation of Italy. Machiavelli also, at this point, had spent so long out of Florence that he was able, almost for the first time, to see Florence with some measure of detachment. He was separated from the humanist ideology and environment of republican liberty in which he had grown up and to which he was so completely and absolutely committed. He saw that Florence was, in fact, a very minor player in a game of life and death. He realized that the very existence of Florence was in question, not just the ability of Florence to remain free, but whether Florence would survive at all. He also came to the conclusion, very reluctantly, that there are times when concepts like freedom and liberty might have to be temporarily sacrificed for greater goods like existence and safety and security. Machiavelli then had met the Duke Valentino of the Prince, that Cesare Borgia figure who would come to represent the man on horseback that Machiavelli saw as perhaps the savior of Italy. Machiavelli then had listened carefully to the French and others about the circumstances in which Florence found itself. In particular, the French, who despised the Florentines for not fighting their own wars, the chivalric tradition of the French knights saw the Florentines hiring others to fight for them as so low as to be beyond contempt, made Machiavelli wonder, in fact, whether the French had something. He wasn't wondering about their chivalric traditions. He had no interest or use for those. But he, in fact, remembered his reading of the Roman historians. He remembered Livy, and he remembered that the Romans had conquered the world using citizen armies of volunteers, disciplined, well-rewarded, and respected and honored. These citizen armies could galvanize a people, could reinvigorate them and give them strength and a sense of purpose. So Machiavelli began filing away this information as well. He saw it, perhaps, as the necessary antidote to the fractious, luxury-loving Florentines. It worked for the Roman Republic. Why couldn't it work for his own people? He pressed Soderini heavily on this, and ultimately in 1507, Soderini gave Machiavelli the chance to do something about it. Machiavelli was given the right to establish a citizen militia, a citizen army, when he was appointed the director of the Ten on War, in effect the military commissariat of Soderini's Republican government. Machiavelli spent much of the Republic's treasure and a good deal of his own time and energy on the training and equipment of this army. They had the latest equipment, they were superbly trained, everything looked towards the future of Florence defending itself and not having to spend treasure on others, mercenaries, taking the money away from Florence, rather spending it internally in order to reward its citizen soldiers. The citizen army had an opportunity to prove itself. The Holy League, under the direction of the Pope, directed itself against the French army in Italy, to, under the war, the rallying cry of Julius II, out with the barbarians, drive them out of the peninsula. Florence, though, was a close ally of France and was left desperately exposed as a result of the league against the French organized by the Holy See. The French army, moreover, was largely defeated, as we've seen. What was left was a very powerful army of Spanish veterans, battle-hardened, experienced, and it was against this army that Machiavelli was told he had to lead his militia. He gathered them at Prato, a town just outside of Florence that boasted excellent defenses, very stout, thick walls, and the militia outnumbered the Spanish veterans considerably. But it just took a small breach in those walls by Spanish artillery for the citizen army, so expensively trained, so well equipped, to throw down their arms and run away. With the evaporation of Machiavelli's militia, there was nothing between this group of Spanish veterans under the control of the papacy and the walls of Florence. Soderini saw there was no hope for his regime, as we've seen in Lecture 28, and he simply resigned and fled into exile. The Spaniards, under the influence of Giovanni de' Medici, that second son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, entered Florence. Machiavelli, of course, was on the losing side. With the return of the Medici in 1512, he lost his job, and he was later implicated, falsely, in a plot against the Medici. He was tortured and thrown into prison. All that there was found on a member of the anti-Medicean party was a list of names, and on that list was Machiavelli's. It only took that for Machiavelli to not only lose his freedom for a period of time and be tortured, but also to be so completely and absolutely isolated from the new regime that he had no hope of employment. He was poor, suspect, indeed in danger of his life. So he wisely decided to leave Florence and retire to a tiny farm that his family owned at the village of San Casciano, just outside of Florence. And indeed, on a clear day, he could see the tower of the Palazzo della Signoria and the top of Brunelleschi's dome from his small farmhouse. It was 1513, and Machiavelli seemed to have no prospects and no future. But this forced retirement, as in the case of so many out-of-work politicians, allowed him to think and to write. It gave him the leisure to work on his literary and his historical works that have given him his reputation up to this day. The most famous book he wrote was a very, very small one in the context of his very, very large output. The Prince, in fact, arose from a correspondence, a series of letters between Machiavelli in exile at San Casciano and his very close friend and Republican associate, Francesco Vittori. that began in the spring of 1513. Machiavelli, with his experience at the court of Louis XII, began rehearsing the dangers to Italy that the French posed. Louis XII clearly was still a great danger, and if his successor, who would clearly at that point be Francis I as Duc d'Angoulême, would in fact follow his desire for glory, Italy would once more become a battleground. Machiavelli began by rehearsing the situation of Italy that had started with the French invasions of 1494, began by rehearsing a set of events that took the control over the peninsula away from his fellow Italians. He focused on how the Italians had the responsibility, the duty, to protect their culture, in fact, to protect civilization altogether by driving out the barbarians, by presenting a united front to them, by overcoming the division and the factionalism that characterized Italian life. It was necessary to learn the methods of the barbarians themselves, as he had seen with Cesare Borgia. The Italians then had to become brutal and ruthless. They had to be like the barbarians if they were to survive. And once the barbarians were expelled, and once the Italians could live in peace, then those terrible traits could be forgotten and abandoned, and Italian liberty restored. It's from Machiavelli's side of this so-called peace correspondence with Vittori that his little book, The Prince, arose. In fact, the letter between Machiavelli and Vittori of the 10th of December 1513 that announces the birth of the prince, so to speak, is perhaps the single most famous letter in the Italian language. And it's worth quoting at some length because it reflects the life of a great man in exile and his attitudes, and it also indicates his continued humanism and his belief in the role of history and learning and republican freedom. Machiavelli writes, "I get up early in the morning and go into some woods I have, which are being cut down, and I spend a couple of hours inspecting the work that the workmen had accomplished during the previous day. I spend some time with them, and they always have some dispute. It's usually over nothing, but nevertheless, it's between them or their neighbors. I leave the woods, and there I go to a little spring, and from there to an uccellare, a bird snare, and there I am happy. I sit because I have a book under my arm. I read Dante, Petrarch, or one of the minor poets like Tibullus or Ovid. I read about their passion and their loves, and I remember my own. And this for a while makes me happy. Then I make my way along the road to the inn, and I talk to those who come in, and I ask of news of where they're from and about various matters, and I simply observe mankind. And I look at the variety of their taste and experience and the huge diversity of their fancies. But at that point, I return home. I go to my small house and eat the poor food that my modest patrimony can provide. But when I finish dining, I go back to the inn, and there usually is the innkeeper, a butcher, a miller, a few brickmakers, and with them I play the rustic for a while, playing cards, playing backgammon, and these games lead to shouting matches that can be heard all the way to San Casciano. They're only over a penny or two, but nevertheless, it is what gives us our day. Cooped up amongst this vermin, I thereby get the mold from my wits. I curse fortune, accepting to walk down the road that she has directed me, if only she shows some sign of contrition of how I have been treated by her. But when evening comes, I return home and enter my study. On the threshold, I take off my daily mud-stained clothes and put on instead the robes of court and palace. Dressed in this way, I step back into the venerable court of the ancients, where they so graciously receive me, and I am nourished on that food for which I was born and which is mine alone. I am not ashamed to ask them questions, to ask the motives for their actions, and they in their great humanity reply to me. They answer me, and for 4 hours at a stretch I feel no boredom. I forget all of my misfortunes. I no longer dread poverty. I no longer even fear death. I am totally absorbed in them. And because Dante reminds us that no one can understand or remember anything without writing, I have recorded my thoughts on this matter in a short treatise, De Principatibus, on principalities in Latin. And in this, I look deeply into the topic of principalities and define the categories of principalities and how they are acquired, how they're sustained, and why it is that princes lose power. And if any of my fancies has interested you, this should not be of no importance. And it could be particularly useful to a prince, especially a new prince. Hence, I plan to dedicate it to His Excellency, de Medici. The prince, then, is the product of a particular moment. It's why it's so totally misunderstood. From the time of its composition, it's been seen as an abstract work of political theory that suggests that tyranny is the solution to all political problems, and that faithfulness and all of the other elements that come out of the tradition of the medieval speculum principis, that advice to princes that Machiavelli takes as a genre and then turns on its head, all of this is in fact wrong. It's not a work of abstract political theory. It's an occasion piece. It's the product of a particular moment in Florentine history, a desperate moment, a moment that drove Machiavelli into despair, and a moment that cost him his own job. It has to be read, then, as the exercise of a committed republican who is looking temporarily to tyranny as the instrument to save Italy, to expel the barbarians and use their methods against them. Machiavelli, then, is not counseling this as a way for the future, but as a necessary example of how the barbarians will have to be beaten at their own game. The Italians, he implies, are actually too civilized in order to stop the barbarians. You have to behave like them to drive them out so that civilization and liberty can reign. He also saw it as a wake-up call for the Italians. He wanted to raise their collective defense, their collective sense of being Italian. He wanted them to avoid the internal factionalism and strife. The barbarians, he said, will always capitalize on the division of the Italians until they actually get their act together and behave as one people. It's for this reason that the final chapter, chapter 26 of The Prince, is part of a poem, the Italia Mia of Petrarch, in which he notes that in the Italian breast, the Roman heart is beating still. And this is Machiavelli's advice to his contemporaries. Well, Machiavelli, at the same time he was writing The Prince, was writing a book of political theory, a book much more abstract, which purports to be a kind of humanist commentary on the first 10 books of Titus Livius, that is, the decades of Livy, the early historian of Rome. And it isn't really about that at all. It's really about Florence and the condition of Italy in the first decades of the 16th century. It's self-consciously republican. The real Machiavelli shows himself. He, too, talks about the need of a man on horseback, a dictator, someone who will function as a kind of drill sergeant who will re-energize the Italian people. And so what he does, then, is he says, this is the necessary moment, but then, as with the example of Cincinnatus, once he has done his job, he should retire and allow freedom once more to reign. It was, like much of Machiavelli's brilliant analysis, essentially naive. How can one escape one's humanist learning? How can one escape the ideology of republicanism that formed him so completely? Well, he can't. The Prince is one side of this, the commentaries on Livy the other. And without the two together, Machiavelli's complex vision can never be fully understood. As a result of his continual importuning of the Medici, including his dedication of the prince to Giuliano de' Medici, and this Giuliano who is represented by Michelangelo in the new sacristy of San Lorenzo in Florence, Machiavelli was finally given a job. He was given a job by Cardinal Giulio de' Medici, that is the cousin of Leo X, as official historian with a responsibility to write the history of Florence and the affairs of Italy. Machiavelli found this a rather difficult task. He was a brilliant historian, and he had written forms of history, really, for much of his life. But this was a problem because he would have to praise the Medici regime, and he would also have to denigrate the Republican period between 1494 and 1512. He, in fact, would have to interpret this from a pro-Medici perspective, when he himself had been not only a supporter of the Republic, but an active agent of Soderini. Still, he did his work extremely well, and by 1525, he brought the very large work up to the year 1492, that is, the year of the death of Lorenzo the Magnificent. And Machiavelli did it in his usual clever and brilliant way. He had the greatest respect for the foreign policy of the Medici, beginning with Cosimo and the Peace of Lodi. He saw these as the examples of what Italy needed now, the Italian states working in concert in order to achieve goals. He attributed much of the peace and stability of the peninsula and the lack of foreign intervention to the success of the foreign policy of Cosimo de' Medici and his successors. He was then able to sustain a pro-Medician perspective, and he could then limit what he truly felt about the loss of liberty, especially after 1480. In 1525, happy with his work, he went to Rome to present it to Giulio, who now, in fact, was Pope Clement VII. Giulio was extremely pleased. The Pope liked the work, and he also liked what Machiavelli had done. So he offered him an annual stipend and some very minor official work. It seemed as though Machiavelli had finally been reconciled with the new regime and that he had entered the service of the Medici. The Medici were so pleased, in fact, with the history of Florence that he was offered a pension and, indeed, that Machiavelli had enough money to return to Florence and live amongst his old friends in this intellectual and cultural environment that he so respected and loved. He had no high rank as he had under Soderini in the Republic, but he now had a regular income, he had some measure of respect, and for Machiavelli, very importantly, he had work. But the crisis in Italy that would culminate in the unspeakable barbarism of the sack of Rome in 1527 was for Machiavelli both the terrible cosmic disaster that he had worked so hard to try and prevent. It was also a personal disaster because it led to his second fall. As a result of the sack of Rome and the loss of Medici authority, with Clement VII a prisoner, in effect of Charles VII and Castel Sant'Angelo unable to do anything, the Medici were thrown out of Florence and the Republic reasserted itself. Machiavelli believed that, fervent Republican that he had been, and given that the new Republic of 1527 was largely driven by some of his closest friends and associates, including Francesco Vittori, he thought there was no problem whatsoever about his re-entering government at the level that he had enjoyed under Soderini. He would then be able to contribute not just to the recovery of liberty, but to the salvation of Italy, so necessary now as the events of 1527 had proved. Ironically, his having accepted a pension from the Medici now made him suspect amongst the ferociously republican regime. They had observed that he had reconciled himself to the old regime. They saw him, in short, as a Medici fellow traveler. Those who had been his friends and close colleagues now rejected him. He was refused high office, and in fact, he was seen with suspicion. Shut out of office once more, shunned as a supporter of the Medici, which in fact he never was. He was someone who just needed to have access to work in government, and melancholy, in fact, in many ways, personally shattered by the events of the sack of Rome, which seemed to illustrate so well the dangers in which all of Italy and Italian Renaissance culture saw itself. Machiavelli died embittered in that same year of 1527. The death of Machiavelli wasn't a direct result of the sack of Rome, but in many ways it was collateral damage. Machiavelli had dedicated his life to the idea of republican freedom, the idea of the dignity of the individual, and the concept of humanism being the instrument that would sustain these in the face of the most barbarous actions then imaginable. He couldn't imagine the sack of Rome. It went beyond even his rich knowledge and experience. He also saw his own humiliation, and he realized that he was not part of the solution. He couldn't offer what he thought he had, and that is experience and wisdom that could help save Italy from the barbarians.